This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Nathan Garrett was born in the 1930s in Tarboro, but he calls Durham home. While many communities were struggling because of the Great Depression, Nathan's dad did his homework and found a place with its own banks and insurance company, a place where black businesses were plentiful and could provide most of what the community needed. So Durham is where Nathan grew up and later started his own CPA firm. Last week, we took a broad look at Durham's Black Wall Street. Today, we'll see it through the eyes of one successful businessman. Nathan Garrett, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
Talk about your father's decision to move to Durham back when he decided to, when he made that decision.
Well, in the Depression, in a small town in eastern North Carolina, the income was not great for African Americans. So he could not very well support a wife and four children. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest of the four, and decided that he wanted to move someplace else where there was more possible income. As it turned out, although he sort of liked Winston-Salem better for some reasons that I never understood, he discovered that actually the income to African Americans in Durham, the access to debt capital, at least, in Durham, was a lot better, and decided this is where he could make a better living for that family that he had.
And how much did he know about all of that? Because it's one thing to make a living, right, to earn income for your family. And, of course, in the Depression, that was everybody's problem. How am I going to get enough money? But this idea of debt capital, the idea that there'd be money to invest and circulate in a community, how much of that did he know about?
I think he must have known a fair amount about it. He was an educated man. He'd gone to Howard University and had gotten his pharmaceutical, really a PhD, a doctorate in pharmacy. And I'm sure that he had learned enough about the finances of Durham than most people would have. Now, he had some interviews with Dr. Clyde Donnell, who at that time was the health officer at North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. But he also had ownership of what was a pharmacy in Durham, and that pharmacist had not made a living out of it. It was all had its own furniture and all of that sort of thing. And he told my dad, when dad came by to look at everything, that he would make sure that the doctors that he knew would provide their prescriptions for Garrett's Biltmore Drugstore, and that he could keep the furniture. And so anyway, it was a good deal for him.
Yeah, so he knew about this stuff. He's a pharmacist. He's looking around, does his homework, finds out about Durham, and so talk about the role that your dad's pharmacy played in the community.
He had a fountain that served ice cream, made ice cream sodas, made milkshakes. And he had about four booths in the right rear of the store, and two or three tables that displayed stuff he was selling, but people could also sit down and enjoy their drinks and their ice cream and so forth. So every Sunday, well, really every day, almost every evening, people were coming by and enjoying themselves in those booths. When I worked in the store, I made a whole lot of milkshakes and a whole lot of, dipped a whole lot of ice cream. He had brought from Tarboro a company with him that had not really invaded Durham. It was called Seal Test Ice Cream.
Oh, yeah.
And they came to Durham because York Garrett had opened a drugstore in Durham, and in Tarboro, he also had a soda fountain.
Well, that's interesting, because that's a national brand. That was a national brand even by then, right?
But they weren't in Durham. They were not selling in Durham.
That's interesting. And so, but he had enough success in Tarboro that he could, well, obviously, he contracts with them. And right. Everybody brings the term fascinating. Of course, there's stories about seal test going forward in the history of the struggle, but we won't get into that just now. I want to talk more about you. You graduated from Hillside as valedictorian. You wanted to go to Howard, your dad's alma mater, right?
I sure did.
Like father and sister did. But your dad had other plans for you, apparently.
Yes. Those plans arose because when my father, who was born in 1894, and I guess he must have been about 9 or 10 years old at that time. There was a black young man who came to Tarboro. He was the son of a pastor, and he had graduated from Yale. He was one of very, very few who had ever done that. And he taught my father in Tarboro and really taught him through a 2 or 3 grades, because he just moved along with the students that he had. Anyway, my father decided that, wow, I like this guy. I like what he does. I like how he holds himself and all of that. And he said to himself, he told me this, that when he had children, he'd wanted one of them at least to go to Yale. And I turned out to be the one. I didn't want to, but... when I got that acceptance, I had already gotten my acceptance from Howard, and the one that came in from Yale, and I just cried because I knew darn well I was going to have to go.
And I mean, the difference to the difference between a historically black university like Howard and Yale, where you were one of 4 black men, is that right?
In that class, in that class of 1952, yes, I was.
So, what was that like for you?
It was strange that when I arrived at Yale, I did not know anything about the other 3 black people, and they didn't know one another either.
Yeah.
When I got there, I was put into a what we called the Sachem Woods Barracks. We had a bunch of students there because there weren't enough rooms on campus to house them. And when I walked into the room where I was going to be living, at least for one semester, a full semester, there was this white fellow who was sitting in the top bench. And I opened the door, and he looked at me, and I looked at him. And after a moment, he jumped down and helped me with my bags and so forth. And that was my roommate, really, for a whole year. We stayed together in the second semester of my first year. We moved from there because more rooms had become available. Some people had flunked out and all of that. So they moved us to another rooming situation on what was called the old campus.
You know, I realized just now, I just made an assumption. You cried, Howard, historically black university, and you're going to Yale, where you were, it turns out, one of 4 black students in that class. I made the assumption that when you said you cried, it was for that reason. But why? What was it? What was that it?
Because I wanted to go to Howard.
You wanted to go to Howard. All right. I want to make that.
Dad had this scheme of his to get me into an Ivy League school, but hopefully Yale.
Yeah.
I went back a ways because he even had me to go to a summer school in Hillside, in order to skip a grade in Hillside, so that when I graduated with what had been the class before me, 1948. And the reason for that was he was convinced that in order for me to get into one of the, Yale specifically, I was going to have to go to a one of those prestigious—
like a prep school or something.
Prep schools in New England. But as it turned out, that wasn't necessary, because I took the entrance examination, and I guess I did well enough.
Yeah, apparently so. And you got into— now, you talked about your roommate who, you know, after that first moment at the doorway, became very helpful. But there was a little bit of controversy about that roommate. And what was that?
Well, his son called me from Australia. He called me because he did not have information about his father, who had died. He had nothing, no information about him during his college years and really stuff before he became a lawyer and all of that. And he wanted to fill in those gaps. So the reason he called me was because he had somehow come in contact with my memoir that I had written about 6 or 7 years earlier. And in it was reference to his father. So he wanted to know about it. And so I got the guys who had been in the class that I was still in contact with, and I told them if they would please send whatever they had, pictures, whatever they had, to this young man in Australia. He was a Duke University economics graduate, so he knew about this country, but he was in Australia and doing fairly well. At any rate, what I'd only learned after some of these people sent him information was that my roommate had told his parents about this black guy with whom he was living, African-American at that time. And one of his parents, I think it was his mother, said, you go to whatever authority there is in that school and you tell them that you have to have another room. Did that.
We're going to take a break and find out what happened.
Okay.
In just a moment. I'm talking to Nathan Garrett, author of A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As baby boomers age, there are fewer around to remember the days of Black Wall Street and even fewer who owned businesses during its heyday. My guest today is Nathan Garrett. He remembers both. His family ran a pharmacy in the 30s. He would later open a successful CPA firm on Paris Street. And just before the break, we were talking about your roommate at Yale, who you lost touch with, and his son wanted to know more. You start to find out as much as you can and ask others for help, and learn that your white roommate had been told by his parents, once they found out that he had an African-American roommate, at least one of his parents wanted him to switch, to get out of that room. Tell us how that resolved itself.
Frank, don't get mad at me, but I've got to tell you something. I don't remember my history until I was 3 years old. I probably started forgetting a lot of it when I was about 80 years old, 85. Some of what I say might be absolutely untrue, but I'll try to avoid that. But with regard to my roommate...
These days, it doesn't matter anymore. See, when you and I were growing up, it did. But now, say whatever you want, Nathan.
Okay. Right. Anyway, yes. So my roommate, who was always... I was impressed that he was always someone who was nice, and he was obedient of his parents and so forth. He did exactly what he was told to do by... I think his mother. And I was told by his son that person that he talked to, one of the officials at Yale, said that if he insisted on a room change because he was with an African American, he said that it might work a little bit, but he would make sure, that is the official, that he would be my roommate asked to leave Yale because they didn't want people that felt that way. Bob never told me any of that. Never mentioned that at all. And we really got along very, very well, and I was shocked when I got that information from his son.
Wow.
Back in 1980. In 2007 or something like that.
Oh, story. And he'd been carrying that whole time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you graduated now from Yale with a degree in psychology. And, of course, the Korean War was on at the time, right? So what was – you were in a difficult position. Talk about, what was going through your mind at that point.
Well, there was a draft, and I had gone back to Durham, and I was doing some things with my father in his drugstore. Because I knew that I was going to be drafted eventually, and eventually I was. I really had to go downtown and volunteer to be drafted. I don't know why they were waiting, because at that time, if you were not in school, then you were over 18, you had to go. Yeah. Well, I was at that time 21, and not in school, and I was waiting to go, but nobody. Anyway, I got I was inducted into the to the military, into the Army, and went down and served 2 full years as an inductee in Fort Jackson in South Carolina.
You get out and you decide to relocate to Detroit. Tell us why.
Women.
Pretty good reason, I think. Yeah, good.
Anyway, I did. In 54, when I left the military, I did go up to Detroit. And I had decided earlier that I did not want to spend a life practicing something called psychology. I had no respect for the field. And I knew also, because of my experience with Dad, that I really wanted some area of business. I didn't want to be a pharmacist, but I knew there was, because I had, with my father, I had learned a great deal about how to operate a business, how to treat your customers, how to make sure that you don't close your store inadvertently or, without a whole lot of warning. And actually, he had run his store so that it was never closed at any time for any reason, including births, deaths, weddings, whatever it was. That store was open, and Dad told me, you have to do that because you have to make sure that people understand that if they need you, you'll be there during the hours that you said you would, and things like that. I decided I wanted business in some way, and so in Detroit, I went to Wayne State, and in a post baccalaureate program, and I tried a whole lot of different disciplines in the area of business, and was told by the faculty members that I encountered that, wow, Nathan, you're one of my best students in this. And it was economics, it was business management, it was what we knew about technology back then. Whatever it was, there was it. But unfortunately, and we know this, there isn't an offer available to you in Michigan for any of this. And they told me the same thing about accounting. Accounting was my last choice. And I said, well, I got to do something, so I'll just try this. And they did not know about this black CPA firm that was in Detroit that was one of the available things. But what they said was that they told me in accounting that these people are not going to hire you because they are concerned about you being in those firms and perhaps going into one of their clients' offices, and the client wouldn't like it. Now, this is Detroit, not North Carolina. Right. This is Detroit. Right. And it was true because I did go to about 6 or 7 local firms and regional firms and international firms and got the same answer. Garrett, your record in Wayne State is great. We like this Yale certificate. We even like the way you look. But unfortunately, our clients would object, and therefore, we can't hire you. So anyway, I was at Wayne State from 56 until about 58.
Meanwhile, the women part of that was working out for you, right?
Yeah.
Because that's where you met the woman who is now your lovely wife.
And we've been married only 60 years. But we're gonna still work at it, try to find how to stay together.
So a lot of good came from that visit, but it turns out that things are just as bad up north as they are down south. And you decide to come back. Did you decide right away to come back to Durham, or what do you do then when you realize it's just as bad up here as it was down
there? Well, the South had an advantage on this stuff that was bad because you knew darn well that that's what you were facing. You couldn't do this, you couldn't do that because of your race. Detroit didn't have those regulations and laws and so forth, so you didn't always know what to do.
Yeah.
And that's worse than having the stuff out in the open so you know you must do something.
Now, there was that black-owned CPA firm.
Yes.
We'll talk about their success and how they managed to get through it all and why you couldn't find a job there. I mean, that seemed to be the place, right?
Well, I did find a job there. They didn't need anybody, but I was very fortunate. I had taken a course in taxes at Wayne State, and I went out there to visit Richard Austin. He was on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. And he and his tax partner sat with me in the tax library and talked about my background and all of that. And they were impressed with that. But I was told by Richard Austin that, you know, although they liked all of my background and so forth, that there was just that did not have a need to hire a new person. Mm. And at that time, the phone rang. And the tax partner picked it up and said, mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And then he hung up. And so the managing partner says, well, what was that all about? And the tax partner told him what the issue was that he was being asked to solve for one of his tax clients. And the tax partner had told him, well, I'll call you back later to, you know, give you my answer. At that time, I'd stood up after having been told they didn't need anybody. I stood up and walked across the room to the shelves where the tax library was, pulled out a book, opened it, found a page, and I told the tax partner, I think this is your answer. The managing partner said, you're hired.
There you go.
But I wasn't a genius. Yeah. I had just happened to have read that very issue a week before I had my conversation with them. Anyway, they did hire me, and I was paid $15 a week. And I was not unhappy with anything except the $15 a week. Mm. Anyway, that's how that happened.
And so what kind of work do you have? Because that suggests then that if there was that kind of discrimination and white firms weren't going to hire you out of fear that their white clients would find out, then that suggests that a black CPA firm was doing business with a lot of black-owned businesses. Would that be right?
Yes, and in Detroit, that was the case. They had a savings and loan. They had drugstores that were owned by a black person. They had, you know, several things, mortuaries and all of that kind of thing. And they did go to Richard H. Austin and Company for their accounting services. So, yes, there was work to be done. But the amount of work was all with black people. There was nobody in the white community that would ask this firm to do anything. Richard Austin had gone through the same problems that I had 15 years earlier when he came to Detroit and had gotten in the education that he needed. He found out that from one of his white professors, a Jewish person, I think it was, he could not satisfy the experience requirement in order to become a CPA because he couldn't go into any client's office when he was hired by a white CPA. But the teacher was so impressed with Dick Austin that he brought him in and just told him, okay, you can do your work here, you can get your experience here, but you cannot leave the office to do anything telling people that you work for me. But he got his experience. And he passed the exam, and that's how he was able to do it.
And then able to start his own firm.
Right. And then he attracted three other people, two of whom stayed with him after they passed the CPA examination. One of them decided he wanted his own firm, and so he didn't. And I became there were the four black CPAs in Michigan. I became the fifth.
Was that when did you begin to start thinking right away about then starting your own firm?
No. Because Austin was really impressed with the quality of the work that I did. I didn't know it was great, but he thought it was. And I know that had I stayed there after I passed the CPA examination, which I did in 1961, Well, I just knew that he was going to ask me to become a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I had decided that I really think that with my CPA certificate and knowing that I was the only Black African-American in North Carolina to pass the CPA examination and become a certified public accountant. Since I knew that, I said, I think I'd like to go back to Durham. And for the same reasons that my father had gone back, moved from Tarboro to Durham, same reasons, except that I knew that there was practically no competition for me in Durham. So I thought it would be a good move.
And there were these arteries of capital that were flowing through a Black community there, unlike others. Were you aware, I mean, at that point or growing up or maybe after you had left, how unique that was for the South to have a middle class like that?
Yes, I did. I was aware of that because I had interactions with the people at the bank. My mother did all of the financial work for my father. So I was well aware that that Durham was unique. I had heard about the history of these North Carolina Mutual and Mechanics and Farmers Bank and, the at that time, the Mutual Community Savings and Loan. So I knew about all those people. I knew the owners. Well, not owners, but they were the leadership. And I knew members of their family because we were in the middle class. So I knew about all of this.
And for a CPA, I mean, it's one thing to communities all over the South, Black communities had services that they were African Americans were providing for each other, but that you don't always need a CPA in those communities, right, to manage those businesses. You need enough businesses and capital flowing through, I would think, to actually attract a professional of your caliber.
Well, Frank, one of the mistakes I made when I got back home and took some office space up on at a 20 floor walk up with Floyd McKissick, an attorney.
Senior.
he had a special room, so an extra room, so I took it, and I used his secretary to answer my telephone when I wasn't there, and so forth. And I did not have very many clients.
Uh-huh.
And I found out the reason was that some of those people, when I talked to them about doing their tax work or whatever, would say, well, they had, I'd say, well, let me look at your past income tax returns. And in several of them, and this is just an example, what they showed me were income tax returns from the last 3 or 4 years in which the amount they bought, this might be a grocery store or something else, the amount of things that they bought, the cost of those exceeded in all of those years the amount of revenue they earned from that. So what that meant was that you had a negative gross profit. You had a gross loss. And I said, well, how can you do this? You've got a daughter that's in college over in Greensboro. You've got cars. You've got a home. How could you possibly make it when you don't even have enough to pay the rent according to your tax returns? And they said, well, we'll talk to you about that later.
That's the miracle of accounting, isn't it? As I thought that's the American way.
For some, you're right. And you know, Frank, there's still an element of that still, and I know it, in Durham and probably in other cities, because the ability to earn was limited because the people with whom they were providing services, whatever there was, were not willing. We're not able to get beyond the Black community. Our Black business community was great. It allowed everybody there, and I heard this on your program on Friday, everybody there would be able to stay right there except for one or two things they might need to go across town for those businesses. And when they went across town to those businesses, they were finding out that either they couldn't go in or they were not treated as the white customers were. So that was the situation.
Talking to Nathan Garrett today, his memoir is called A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. Just ahead, how he built wealth in minority communities and the nonprofit, the North Carolina Fund. We'll talk about all of that in just a minute. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Nathan Garrett's family pharmacy is part of the history of Black Wall Street. He was able to get his CPA license in Detroit, came back to Durham, where he is believed to be the first licensed accountant in the state of North Carolina, the first Black licensed accountant, I should say, in the state of North Carolina. And we're talking with Nathan Garrett today, who's part of the legacy that helped build and maintain Black Wall Street. So we got you out of Detroit, but I should probably talk for a moment about your wife, because she was raised in that area. She was from there.
Yes, she was born and was raised in Detroit.
So now, what'd she think about coming to a place called Durham, North Carolina?
She was happy to do it. My problem was that she had three brothers who didn't want her to go back behind what they used to call the cotton curtain. So I had problems with them, and but we finally worked them out, and we were able to move everything to Durham in 1962.
How was the adjustment for both of you? Because you're actually having to readjust to some degree.
Well, my wife had done her college work down in Arkansas, where her family's roots were.
Yeah.
So she was accustomed to the practices in southern communities. Where it was a little town called Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And the university is still there that she attended. And when she went back to Detroit, after that, she was not unwilling, because she had a lot of skills in communications, in almost everything having to do with either acting or whatever. Anyway, she was good. And she decided that was what we wanted to do. But we also wanted to move, because at that time, with both of us working and with a child that we had who was in school at that time, and he would have to come home when neither of us could be there. And there were problems with that in Michigan at that time. So we decided that it will be better if we go down south, where we've got people who can help us out, and where we've got more flexibility about what would happen on the home front.
Well, you know, that people who can help us out part, that community all kind of filling in, is something that, as you say, we talked about this broadly, Black Wall Street, on Friday. But something I wanted to probe more deeply, and that is this form of capitalism that forms when you have a minority community that doesn't have access to broader lines of capital, but in an environment like Durham, can generate capital, and that capital flows. The one thing we heard over and over again was the sense of mutuality, the sense of community support, that people were going to go to those businesses and not have to squeeze the last nickel out of a dollar, because they understood they had a responsibility to a community and a responsibility to make a profit, to make a living.
Well, that was working for those businesses that were in Durham when we moved from Tarboro, and it remained there. The problem was, however, that when the anti-discrimination laws and regulations were passed in 1964 in that area, in Johnson's presidency, I thought it was a good idea. And then within a few years, I realized that, wow, these people are losing customers. They are going to those stores where they could not go before. They were going to theaters where they could not go before. The theaters on our part of town were suffering from that, because people were not coming in from the white communities to do that, and they didn't come to our restaurants and so forth. So the problem was that there was just a huge loss of of customers. For instance, let's take North Carolina Mutual. I served on that board from 1978 to really 2003 or something of that sort. And I was the chairman of that board for 13 years. But what I learned there was that that company was able to survive only because it had that segregated market. People who were buying insurance were paying 5 cents a week for those policies. And those 5 cents were being collected by agents who walked around through the community where all the black people were, and they could walk from house to house and talk to mama and daddy and the kids and so forth. And that was working fine, and that's how they were able to continue to grow. But when the non-discrimination happened, and with the housing and so forth, then those agents could not walk from where they were all the way across town.
They didn't have cars to
pick up those So it.
But obviously, you're not making an argument for reinstituting Jim Crow, right?
No. But the same thing happened to us slowly, that because of the decline in the people who really wanted our services, and also because of the competition that developed.
Talk about your. I want to, because I know we've only got a few minutes left, and I do want to talk about the North Carolina Fund. And that was a remarkable, and it became actually the template for the War on Poverty. Ultimately,
yes, it was.
Lyndon Johnson calls Terry Sanford and says, "Hey, I hear you got a program down there in North Carolina."
That's right.
Tell me about it and your role in it.
I was asked by the executive director on the recommendation of John Wheeler, who at that time was the president of Mechanics Farmers Bank and who was on the board of that entity. If he said that you ought to hire Nathan Garrett to be your chief fiscal officer, because they had about $9 million in grants that were going to be paid over a 5-year period of time from Ford in New York, Ford Foundation, and from the Z. Smith Reynolds and the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundations in Winston-Salem. And this is all started by Terry Sanford, who was governor at that time. And his mission was to break the cycle of poverty in North Carolina. And that's why those grantees, grantors, sent money. They also, however, had a policy or a strategy that said that we want to break this cycle of poverty, but we want to do so through evolution, not revolution. And when I talked to George Esser, who was the executive director, the top official, we talked about that, and I agreed that made sense. That whole board, other than two blacks, were white men and women who had, you know, who were really very important people in the state of North Carolina that had been selected by the then governor. Anyway, I decided that this was a mission that I needed to lend my help to, and so I did, and I became the CFO. But over the years, as I moved up from chief fiscal officer to chief of several operating areas, and then eventually in charge of everything under George Esser, the executive director, it became clear to me, the more I found out about our programs, was that this thing of strictly evolution rather than revolution was not going to work, because what you had was a society in the U.S., especially in the South, where the decisions that were made by people on boards in executive positions and so forth, those decisions were great for a majority of the population, but they weren't great for blacks. And that was because blacks were not a part of the process. They didn't know about the housing. They didn't know about the problem with health care. They didn't know about the roads that weren't paved. These things were a serious problem, and we had to find a way to get Black people in positions inside of government, inside of businesses, so that they could provide this additional information to the decision-making process. So that caused the Foundation for Community Development to decide to change that policy slightly. And we were doing community organization all over the state, North Carolina Fund was, but we were not able to fund those community organizations directly because those capital, those nonprofit businesses that were responsible for doing that, their boards, practically all white, were saying, no, we're not going to give these organizations, local, community organizations, direct money. We will pass it through from you to them, but we are not going to support you allowing them to get the money directly.
But that meant it was a centralized organization and you weren't getting the grassroots understanding how to spend this money.
And that's what eventually led to the creation of the Foundation for Community Development, which it's because of a program that I wrote up and gave them the information about why this was important to be able to do this directly, and also gave them information about how the thing would be run. And we had a board at the Foundation for Community Development that was majority people who had come from low-wealth communities all over the state. But we also had people who were in business, in education, and so forth, who also joined that board. But the low-wealth representatives were all in the majority. On the boards of those organizations that were funded by the North Carolina Fund, that was never the case. It was always the businessmen and so forth. And the people who were represented from the low-wealth communities, if they voted the wrong way on things, if they were in business, they could lose some of that business, et cetera. So you see the problem.
How would you rate the success? Because we've heard of very recently Paul Ryan sort of declared the war on poverty was a failure, and I think that's now the dominant view. It certainly isn't true in my study. It really did lift people out of poverty and create a better balance between classes than we've ever had in this country while these programs were in effect. But I wonder what your take is from your point of view.
My take is this. At the Foundation for Community Development, we focused on community organization in low-wealth communities. Some of them were up in the mountains, and they were white. Some of them were down in Robeson County, where we had Indians and so forth. And all over the state, Wilson, Rocky Mount, et cetera. We were doing community organization. And what we discovered was that when our community organization people began to talk to people they were going to try to enlist to join these local community organizations, that those people, when they talked to them, told our staff that what we really need, in addition to paved streets and better health care and so forth, we also need stores in our communities. We need a variety of things that usually are provided by businesses. And so therefore, community economic development was added to what we were doing. Over the years that I was the head of FCD, we had success. In terms of the business development, we had community development corporations that were doing things in communities with some money that we provided as the original capital, but also money that was being provided by those
businesses.
By those people who were going to them right. for the services. And that worked pretty well. But in about 1970, we had a blow from the Ford Foundation, and I knew it was coming because in 1969, Congress had passed the 1969 tax reform bill. And in that bill, what they said was that if you are a private foundation, you cannot do anything in community organization or anything else that is designed to influence legislation, to influence elections, and to influence regulations even, which is, you know, what the city councils and so forth were doing. And we were doing that in the community organization. And Ford actually told us, look, we really like what you've been doing with the economic development and so forth. And by that time, I think we must have had 50 or 60 community development organizations around North Carolina. And they said, we want to continue to fund you, because North Carolina Fund had closed by that time. But we want to continue to fund you. But if under the 1969 Act, if we fund you to continue to do this right. this work with people on legislation, that sort of thing, we could lose our tax-exempt status. And they weren't going to do that. So that's what caused me to decide to resign from the Foundation for Community Development, because I could not understand how we could do the economic development without pairing it with right. community organization.
Nathan Garrett, a retired CPA. His father was a pharmacist on Black Wall Street, grew up, opened a CPA firm on Paris Street, and contributed to the vibrance of Black Wall Street and to our communities ever since. Nathan Garrett, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope I haven't misdirected some of your listening audience.
You were great. And he shares a story in his memoir, A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. You can find out more about the book and his life at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, with Robin Copley as our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.